During a recent visit to Britain, Aldous Huxley recorded for the BBC a number of conversations talking on different occasions with both Walter Allen and John Morgan. The programme that follows is a selection from the various recordings he made, introduced by Walter Allen.
For me, talking to Aldous Huxley was a great occasion. For Huxley's been one of the formative influences on my life. And I imagine something similar is true for a very large number of men and women of my generation. Men and women who were at the universities in the last years of the 20s and the early years of the 30s. But in recent years, I found myself thinking from time to time how splendid it would be if we had a comparable figure about today. And increasingly, I've begun to admire the single-mindedness, the intellectual honesty, the receptivity to new experience and new ideas that characterize him. 30 years ago, I was sure he was a great writer. I don't believe that now, but all the same, writers of his like don't come very often, and perhaps more men and women than he'll ever realize owe him a debt of gratitude and are conscious of it. Well, as you see, when I met Huxley in the studios 2 months ago, I was, in a sense, meeting my past. And so, I suspect, was John Morgan. The questions we put were naturally pretty similar. If anything, Morgan's had a sociological bias, mine a literary one. I'd just been rereading with enormous interest the essays in the collection called On Art and Artists, and I made that the starting off point in the first of my talks with Huxley. These essays, which somebody else collected, I think, are not printed in any chronological order, and I found it almost impossible to date the essays as I read them. And I found this sentence in what I think is the earliest essay in the book, written in 1919. The greatest triumphs of art take place in a world that is not wholly of the intellect, but lies somewhere between it and the inenerable, but to those who have penetrated it, supremely real world of the mystic. Well, that, as I say, was written in 1919 and suggests that there's never been any clash in your mind between the skeptic and the mystic.
No, I think that's true. I mean, I don't really see any incompatibility, because the mystical approach to life does not depend upon the acceptance, the intellectual acceptance of certain propositions. Then it seems to me that a mystical religion is no more incompatible with scientific thought than scientific thought is incompatible, say, with music. Both can coexist without contradicting one another.
Well, this ties up, doesn't it, with what with the theme that you've made peculiarly your own, I think, the theme of what one might call the plurality of the universe, whereby any phenomenon becomes entirely different when one changes the point of view. I mean, I'm thinking the obvious example is your treatment of Bach in Point Counterpoint.
Yes, I don't see that one can avoid this. I mean, we are multiple amphibians living in a lot of worlds at once. I mean, the most obvious case is that we live and move and have about 70% of our being in the world of language. But we also live and move and have a good deal of our being in the world of immediate experience, and we have to make the best of both worlds. And there are a number of other worlds, too, which we also have to make the best of in one way or another.
John Morgan raised the question of Huxley's notions on the relation between art and life.
Clearly, from your work, you've derived a very rich experience from a study of art. Now, from a lifetime study of both art and society, would you say that you derived a more rich kind of experience from art than from life?
Well, surely, in a sense, the two things are different. I mean, what art springs from, it seems to me, it springs from a very deep, what may be called an urge to order. I think this is an almost instinctive urge in human beings to impose order upon the profusion and the chaos of experience. And we do it in various ways. We do it in philosophy, we do it in science, we do it in art to impose a symbolic order upon the world. And of course we do it also in society, and this is a real danger, because in a certain sense you can say that the social equivalent of a highly organized work of art is in fact a totalitarian state. The whole problem, it seems to me, of society is to find a way of imposing order without imposing a too rigid order, which you can do in art, of course.
What I was wondering was whether you've tended to regard life as a kind of art form that is subject to the sort of perfectibility that you get in a work of art. I mean, rather than regarding life as a rather sort of vulgar, untidy kind of mess.
Well, I'm completely convinced that one can. There is an art of life. After all, many civilizations have had a real art of living. And I think we're in a position now to be able to understand the art of living much better. I mean, I think we know enough about it from a scientific point of view about psychology and physiology, and we know enough from a literary and historical point of view about what other civilizations have done. I think we're now actually in a position to be able to develop an art of living of a kind which our ancestors couldn't have developed, because we have these resources at our disposal.
That, as we now see, has a great deal of bearing on Huxley's new novel, Island. This is how he described the book to me.
It's an attempt to do the opposite of what I try to do in Brave New World. In Brave New World, I try to draw a picture of a society where a deliberate effort was made to iron out human differences and to create a standardized human product. In this society, which I postulated as existing in a tropical island somewhere between Ceylon and Sumatra, a serious effort is made to help the individual members of the society to realize as many as possible of their desirable potentialities. This is the essential difference. One is what may be called a negative utopia, and the other is a positive utopia. The title is simply Island. It is essentially an island. It's a contemporary fantasy. It's an island within our world, which certainly is not an ideal world. And the problem which I set myself was simply this. How do we implement our ideals? I mean, nothing is easier than to formulate ideals, but nothing is harder than to discover the means whereby those ideals may be put into practice. And what I've tried to do is, so to say, to write a practical utopia, a kind of cookery book of utopia, considering what would one do? I mean, if one wants, it's easy to say, for example, wouldn't it be nice if everybody were good and kind and intelligent? Yes, it certainly would be very nice. But what must we do in order to see that people should behave well and kindly and intelligently? And this entails thinking about what you do in relation to the family life, what you do in relation to sexual life, what you do in relation to social organization and economics, what you do in relation to religion and to education. And I've tried to work this out as practically as I can.
This is, as it were, a vade mecum to the working good life.
Yes, this is essentially what I've tried to do.
The island is set in the east, you say.
Well, it's somewhere halfway between Ceylon and Sumatra.
Is there any significance in that?
Well, there is indeed, because what I've tried to bring together in the island is the two traditions of the east and the west. Let me give a little description of how this island lies and what its relation to the outer world is. There are two islands in this area, divided by a narrow strait. One of the islands happens to have a magnificent harbour and has therefore constantly been overrun during the centuries by foreign invaders. The other island, which is my island, which I call Pala, has no harbour and has never presented any temptation to people. Well, the result is that whereas the other island was overrun first by the Arabs, then by the Portuguese, then by the Dutch, then by the English, and was then given its freedom, say, 15 years ago, and is now, of course, under a military dictatorship, and is exploited by oil companies. This, my island, was never overrun and remains what Java was several hundred years ago, a Mahayana Buddhist island with Shivaite overtones. And owing to a number of historical accidents which I've explained, this island has, for about 100 years, combined Western and Eastern influences in an attempt to use the variable factors in our scientific approach to life and in the Mahayana Buddhist tradition of the spiritual and psychological approach to life. And I've tried to see what would happen if you made the best of both worlds.
And that seemed a good point in which to ask Huxley about Eastern philosophy and its influence on him.
In this particular context, I mean, I think, for example, I myself have a great admiration for the philosophy and the psychology of Mahayana Buddhism, the later Buddhism, which seems to me exceedingly subtle and which also seems to me to have one of the highest ideals ever created by man, whereas the earlier Buddhism conceived that the ideal was what was called the arhat, the pure contemplative who seeks nirvana apart from the world. In the Mahayana tradition, the ideal is what is called the bodhisattva, who refuses to accept nirvana apart from the world and insists on coming back life after life until all sentient beings are liberated. And for him, the life of the contemplative who finds liberation outside the world is the equivalent of hell. I mean, this particular kind of heaven is for him hell because it precludes love and work, which is the essential life of the bodhisattva. And his whole conception is to find the absolute within the relative, to find nirvana in the world of illusion, find eternity within the world of transience and time. And what I've tried to do is to show this kind of a world influenced by Western scientific ideas and trying to work out a really satisfactory society in the light of both the contributions of East and West.
When did you first get interested in Mahayana Buddhism, Mr. Huxley?
Well, I have been, oh, I suppose, for 20 or 30 years increasingly interested in it. I mean, the whole story of Buddhism in relation to Western thought is interesting because in the early phases only the Hinayana Buddhist texts were translated, and it's relatively recently that the Mahayana Buddhist texts have come into prominence and people have realized how extremely subtle and how extremely beautiful, too, these texts are.
Both Morgan and I recalled that Huxley had begun as a satirical novelist and rather regretted that during the past 20 years he'd written much less fiction than before. I asked him if this implied a dissatisfaction with fiction.
No, my goodness, I think that if one can write good fiction, I know nothing more wonderful than to be able to do this. I would love to be a great novelist. I mean, this would... Nothing would please me more, but just I don't think I happen to be very highly gifted in this direction.
Well, there's always been a clash in your fiction, hasn't there, between Huxley the novelist and Huxley the essayist?
Yes, I mean, this has always been my problem, to try to find the concrete expression of general ideas. I mean, in the field of history, I have made two essays there, Adventures into the Historical Field, this book about Father Joseph, Grey Eminence, and
yes,
this book about the Devils of Loudun. And both these subjects interested me particularly because, in a sense, although they are historical facts, they are at the same time parables. They illustrate with extraordinary clarity a number of very important general ideas. And in general, I feel that the expression of abstract ideas is much more penetrating if it somehow can come through concrete biographical or fictional case histories. This is something I'm always looking for. I should love to be able to find a new historical episode which I felt to have the same parable-like quality as these other two.
John Morgan wondered about the influence of D.H. Lawrence on Huxley, and that led, as you'll hear, to a general discussion of changed attitudes towards sex.
If I may turn back to your earlier work, Mr. Huxley, I mean, Chrome Yellow and Antic Hay were two very hilarious novels. And then after them, it seems to me that your work took a more serious turn, became more concerned with society. Did this have anything to do with your friendship with D.H. Lawrence?
No, I don't think so exactly. I mean, Lawrence's concern with society was a concern with a kind of hypothetical society. I mean, he very much disliked the societies he saw around him, and he was always hoping to discover some sort of ideal, rather primitive society. But of course, when he got into the rather primitive societies, he didn't like those very much.
When he went to Mexico, you mean?
When he went to Mexico, for example, I mean, he was always urging people to go back to the dark gods and plunge into the blood, but at the same time he got awfully cross with the Mexicans for being so inefficient and slow and inept. So that there was a curious ambivalence. I mean, if you read that book, The Plumed Serpent, you will find a very ambivalent attitude towards the dark gods and the primitive peoples.
In spite of these sort of contradictions in his attitude, do you find him a very stimulating person?
Oh, I think he was absolutely extraordinary. I mean, I think he's a very great writer, and as a human being, he was a wonderful man. I was very, very fond of him. I saw him first briefly during the First World War, and then I really didn't see him again until 1926. But during the last 4 years of his life, my first wife and I saw him a great deal. We were together in Italy, in Switzerland, in the south of France, and we were with him when he died, actually, in 1930.
We must have been with him when he wrote Lady Chatterley's Lover, and when it was banned, and the pansies were seized, and his picture, the exhibition of pictures
was
raided.
That was a very dramatic moment.
Well, do you think that the recent decision to permit Lady Chatterley's Lover to be sold here is the sort of death of Mrs. Grundyism in this country?
I think Mrs. Grundy is immortal. I very much doubt whether she will ever die. I mean, she has many lives and will probably arise again. I mean, there has, of course, in recent years been a curious resurrection of Grundyism in France, very surprisingly. And I think that this thing does come back from time to time, though in general I do feel that there is a much greater freedom of expression than there was in the past. And of course, this whole business about four-letter words and taboo words raises very interesting artistic problems. I mean, whether Lawrence's solution of using these words in order to raise the sex in its most earthy form to a kind of lyrical level, whether his solution was the artistically best one, I don't know. The trouble is that, in fact, we react to these words with such a violence, we are conditioned to react with such violence that when we come upon them, we tend to give them much too much emphasis. So that, perhaps there's 5% of the book is devoted to two passages in which these words occur. But the impact seems to be something like 85%, and the artistic balance tends to be thrown out. And I don't know what the what the solution is, but I'm pretty sure that this is a solution, but probably not a very good one, not a final one, until these words cease to have this kind of taboo quality.
You say that by and large people nowadays are more outspoken. I mean, do you think that the factors in society which lead people to be extremely puritanical are diminishing, you know, are changing?
I suppose so, yes. It is, I think, very remarkable of the changes that have taken place, and this is partly, I think, the result of the sort of antiseptic scientific approach to the subject. I mean, I think pioneers like Havelock Ellis did an extraordinary work. I remember there was a time when you could go into the British Museum and you couldn't get Havelock Ellis out even for reading in the museum. It was kept under lock and key. But now, certainly in America, I saw it seems to be perfectly freely on sale. So that this kind of scientific approach, I do think, has done a great deal to liberate thinking about these, after all, extremely important problems.
Inevitably, Huxley's experiments with drugs, particularly mescaline, came up. John Morgan put the question in these terms.
How much is your interest in drugs, say, like mescaline, an attempt to find some kind of solution to social as much as individual problems?
Well, I don't think it this particular substance doesn't offer any solution to social problems. It interests me in as much as it permits, under suitable research conditions, the exploration of the stranger and odder areas of the human mind. I mean, this is one of the things which has emerged, I think, in recent years. Not only is the material universe incomparably larger and stranger than we used to give it any credit for, but the mental universe is also larger and stranger than we give it credit for, that we carry about inside our skulls an extraordinary world, a visionary world, a mystical world, and that the interesting fact about these substances is that they open a door and permit us, without doing any harm to ourselves, because this is the most extraordinary fact about these new drugs, without doing physiological harm, to explore this world. From a sociological point of view, obviously these drugs can't be used. But at the same time, I mean, I think sooner or later we shall have to find some kind of substitute for the permitted drug, which is alcohol.
I mean,
it's quite clear that alcohol is incompatible with the automobile. I mean, in America, it is currently calculated that at least 50% of the 37,000 people killed each year by the automobile are killed by people under the influence of liquor. Well, I mean, if we can find a drug which doesn't incite people to drive their cars when they're in a state of incompetence, we've done a great deal. Traditionally, ethyl alcohol goes back to Noah, and I see no reason to suppose that the human ingenuity will not be able to find a better mind-relieving, mind-detensioning drug than this very ancient substance which we still use.
In view of Huxley's apparently encyclopedic knowledge and the scientific distinction of the Huxleys as a family, I asked him what he thought about the alleged cultural split in our society between the scientifically educated and those trained in the liberal arts. C.P. Snow's famous two cultures, in fact.
I feel that he has rather oversimplified the situation. He speaks as though there were nothing in between the Bloomsbury drawing room and the pure physics conversation of dons at a Cambridge college. But there are lots of things in between. There are the historians, the sociologists, the anthropologists, who are, in a scientific way, trying to think about human affairs. And in this sense, there is a bridge between the two cultures. But to me, the interesting problem is this. I don't think you can mitigate scientific specialization with courses in Plato and in literature, for this reason, that both these forms of education are education on the symbolic and verbal level. What we need is to mitigate both kinds of verbal specialization, because the humanities are also a verbal specialization, just as much as science is, to mitigate these verbal specializations with training in what I call the non-verbal humanities. I think what we need profoundly, and this is something I've stressed in this book, is a training of all children, and indeed of all adults, in the art of living, training, for example, in perception, training of the imagination, training of the kinesthetic sense, training in general awareness of everything that we do.
You are someone who, well, I suppose, likes to know himself, but even more so, he straddles both camps.
Well, I'm technically very ignorant in the field of science, and this is another thing. I mean, there is a kind of assumption among certain scientists that it's impossible to understand anything about science unless one has gone right into it. I mean, this is rather like saying that it's impossible to know anything about whales without being Jonah. But you can study whales without being swallowed by them, and you can know more or less what the sciences are about and what they're likely to do to us without actually plunging into it and being a practitioner of any given science.
But to most of us, you seem to be a man of extremely, enormously wide reading, of an enormously wide background, who does command Knowledge, whether at first hand or second hand, doesn't really matter, both the sciences and the arts. How did this come about?
Well, I don't know. I've always been passionately interested. I'm always reminded in this context of a story which I'm very fond of Bertrand Russell. It happened a few years ago, and he was lunching with my brother. My brother was recounting some very peculiar zoological fact about some odd species of animal. And Bertrand Russell listened with greatest attention, and then when my brother had finished, he nodded his head and said, "How nice it is to know things." Well, I've always felt that it was very nice to know things, and I've also always felt that it was very nice somehow to be able to correlate what one knew into some kind of a pattern, because of course one can know things without having any pattern of the little pebbles of knowledge. But this has always been my great passion, to try to make some kind of pattern out of these little fragments of stuff.
I think the final excerpt from these interviews with Aldous Huxley should be John Morgan's concluding questions.
Looking forward over the rest of this century now, what seem to you to be the major problems which must be tackled?
Well, I mean, first of all, there's this question, are we going to blow ourselves up or not? I think and hope that we shall not. But if we don't, then the most urgent problem over the next 50, and I would say 100 years or more, is this problem of explosive population increase. In this country, of course, it's not a major problem, but I mean, when you go to countries, for example, as in Central America, where I was recently, or in South America, and find increases at the rate of 3% per annum, which doubles the population in 24 years, what on earth do you do if you're an underdeveloped country? I mean, even if you can solve the food problem, which in many cases they probably can, what do you do, for example, about the housing problem, about the educational problem? How do you build enough schools? How do you find enough teachers? What do you do about the roads and sewage systems and power systems and so on?
If there were a general enough desire to do something about these things, if there were no war, I mean, armament programs have been cut or some measure of this kind, I mean, is it then possible with the expanding population nevertheless to give everyone a higher standard of living?
Well, I think it is, but I mean, the point is this, that it does look as though quantity were the enemy of quality in this matter. After all, it isn't simply a question of food, it's a question of, is it pleasant to live in a town of 10 million inhabitants such as Tokyo is? Is it pleasant to live in a place with 1,400 people to the square mile such as Barbados is? I mean, is life under such conditions as good as life where as throughout nature there is a balance between the birth rate and the death rate, where you have a kind of stable population based on a low birth rate and a low death rate, where you can plan ahead in a more rational way, and where it seems possible to organize the good life much better?
Are you hopeful or pessimistic, would you say, about the rest of this century? Anyway?
Well, I think I am both. I mean, we have it within our power, I think, to do extraordinary things if we want to. Question is, do we want to enough? And also, do we have enough? It's not merely a question of will, it's a question of extreme intelligence. I mean, we have to use the maximum of intelligence and the maximum of goodwill to solve these problems. I mean, we have to carefully to think out what is going to happen and then to have the desire to do it.
Mr. Huxley, thank you very much indeed.
Walter Allen has been introducing recordings of the conversations he and John Morgan had with Aldous Huxley. The program was presented by the BBC.